support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
A rock star is dead. Bobby? A groupie has disappeared, and millions are missing.
I think that somebody's trying to rip my company off.
Those were his kind of odds. His name? Ford Fairlane.
Hey, it's Ford Fairlane!
Hey, what are your names, Neil and Bob? Is that like what you do, huh?
A detective who's so smooth.
What is it they call you?
Precocious. Combustionable.
He's aerodynamic.
Hey. Cool.
Everyone knows him.
Hey, you're that guy. The private eye.
You're a poet and didn't know it.
Everyone owes him.
Take this, Ford.
Well, money's fine, really. I need cash, moolah, wampum, dead presidents, Michael Jackson, Gerald Ford.
See, that's the difference between a great investigator like me and a piece of spam like you.
Spam?
And nothing they say.
You're a piece of spam. That's what I think of you.
Can throw him.
Mr. Fairlane, when I was 11, I walked in on my father and the Shetland pony he gave me for my 10th birthday. Does that excite you?
I don't know. I never met your father.
But this case can put him back.
I don't need money.
In the black.
I need questions answered. Question number one. Can I have some money?
But when your beat is the music business.
Let me see this chick around.
Is this a trick question?
You keep notes. On everyone.
Got you.
Priscilla Presley.
Who?
I wouldn't trust that babe as far as I could bowl her.
Ed O'Neill.
Booty tag. Booty tag.
Robert Englund. Tone Loke. Gilbert Gottfried. Sheila E. And Wayne Newton.
What?
Yes, Wayne Newton.
And I gotta defeat a baby.
Oh, he seems nice.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh!
Is Ford Fairlane.
Shall I drive his man?
In a movie so hot.
Got something cooking in the microwave?
Get out!
You better bring protection.
No, maybe it was just a pot pie.
Ford Fairlane.
Are you mad?
No, I'm ecstatic!
Coming in July to theaters everywhere.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is Rob St. Mary.
Down, Stanley.
And we're also joined this week by a man who only goes by one name, kind of like Prince, but a little taller. Of course, I'm talking about Feedback.
That is correct. Or Stuart Feedback Andrews, if you're my mother.
Stuart Feedback Andrews, you get in this house right now.
No, she calls me Stuart Feedback Andrews, the four-time Rondo Hatton Award-winning horror journalist.
Wow. Man, that is a mouthful.
Yeah, it is.
Then she says, you get in this house right now. You're late for dinner.
Exactly.
All right. This week, we're talking about The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, a comic neo-noir starring Andrew Dice Clay. It's the story of the titular Fairlane, a rock and roll detective who's hired to chercher la femme, Zuzu Petals. This leads to all manners of twists, turns, body jokes. In essence, the film is kind of a throwback to Raymond Chandler with dick and fart jokes and kind of a slick neon production. So, Stuart, when did you first come across the film and what were your initial thoughts, sir?
Well, before I get into the film, I have to sort of backtrack it because it's in context to my whole awareness of Andrew Dice Clay. The Dice Man Cometh. The 1989 HBO special that he put out. That was my first introduction to him. And I grew up as a teenager in London on Terrible in Canada. At that time, that video was huge. I mean, people were copying VHS tapes of it, handing them around. People were watching them sort of repeatedly. He was a real phenomenon at that point. I was intrigued. Now, I have to give a certain amount of qualifications. I was somewhat enamored with him in terms of his sheer attitude and his bravado, because when I first saw that video, it was a jaw dropper. It's hard to understand looking at it today, but in 1989, when that came out, So he comes out, he does this big production, and Rennie Harlan kind of mythologizes this moment in Ford Fairlane, but he does this big production of like pulling out his cigarettes and like flipping open his Zippo and lighting his cigarette about three different ways and doing all these like fancy moves with his cigarette, and the audience is just going wild for him. I'd never seen anything like it. Like, that first opening line of his act was just so abrasive and inappropriate.
I got my tongue up this chick's ass, right?
And in 1989, honestly, that was just like, wow, where the hell is this coming from? And his act is like really confrontational, really abrasive, really offensive. And at the time, I felt that it was, well, it was a caricature. He was playing a caricature of a very deeply racist, misogynistic ignoramus. The problem with that, though, is, and I think this is the dilemma with Dice, and it's hard to reconcile this. You had people who defended him would say, well, it's just an act. And then people who attacked him would say, well, he's misogynistic and he's racist. Well, it was an act, but it was still feeding into misogyny and racism. It was feeding into reactionary hatred. Because if you see that Dice Man Cometh, the biggest cheers he gets is when he says, like, fag jokes and says things like, get the f*** back in the closet, you know, and the whole audience goes wild. Or when he's going off on Middle Eastern cab drivers and Arabs and, you know, and he's just, it's unbelievable. It's quite shocking. You guys, Rob, have you seen it?
Yeah, I remember seeing it. You know what's interesting is I just rewatched about a year ago one of the early Eddie Murphy stand-ups. And right. To me, there's almost a parallel with the humor where there's all of these jokes that today nobody would do. They're just like racist and sexist and a lot of homophobia.
Well, of course, Eddie Murphy was very homophobic for sure. But Dice Clay in the Dice Man Cometh, he takes it to a level I've never actually heard anyone do. You know, I've never heard all the racist comics out there, but it was so in your face. It's really shocking. I mean, Sarah Silverman creates controversy because she tiptoes around certain racial sensitivities today because we're so much more politically sensitized. But in 1989, this was before people started to really challenge these kind of depictions of varying marginalized groups in the media. So, and before there was a really kind of extreme left backlash against these kind of depictions. In fact, Dice was a pioneer in this whole thing because there was a huge backlash against him, which we'll talk about with Ford Fairlane because it really compromised that movie. You know, and the other thing was interesting, it was Howard Stern wrote about him in Private Parts, and he says, you know, everyone knows Dice Clay, it's just an act. But I'll tell you, it's not just an act. And he recounts this whole episode about going house hunting with him, driving around looking for a house, and how obnoxious and just ignorant Andrew Dice Clay was. And I think it's a case where his persona, because it was a very deliberately constructed persona, got the better of him. And he started to live into the persona. And in preparation for doing this interview with you guys, I dug around on YouTube and saw some recent interviews with him. And he's definitely settled into some version of the Dice Clay persona that has kind of become him, and they've become indistinguishable. The other thing that's interesting is he was a Jew. He never addressed that in his act because he was sort of playing himself like he was some sort of OG from New Jersey or Brooklyn. And in fact, Jews were one of the groups he did not target in his act. So it wasn't a sort of equal opportunity discrimination. You know, he would go after all these other groups viciously, but he was very careful that he would leave the Jews alone. So it's a bit disingenuous.
It's funny. He's always played Italians in almost everything that he's done, maybe with the exception of his role in Crime Story, where he played Max Goldman. But otherwise, it was like Tony Baroni, Tony Schlangini, Frankie, Vinny. You know, it's always this kind of Jersey Shore trash kind of stuff.
My problem with him is that, yes, it's an act, but there was no satirical value to it. There's nothing subversive. He wasn't exposing anything. Initially, because I was enamored with him, I kind of gave him credit for doing that. But really, to be honest, revisiting it, there's no value to what he's doing. And you can see that in the audience reaction. He's really just, he may as well have been sincere in his beliefs. The thing is, and you have to rent this video. Actually, you can see the whole thing on YouTube. The thing that blew me away, and it blew everyone away, was at the very last bit of his act, he does this routine where it's like Eric Roberts, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, John Travolta. He does them all as Boy Scouts around a campfire. And he cycles through these pitch-perfect impressions of those five guys, from their mannerisms, which he exaggerates greatly, but to great effect, to the tone of his voice changes to fit them exactly.
Hey, yo, fellas, you want to roast some marshmallows? Who's got the marshmallows? At De Niro, you got marshmallows.
And that was, I think, more than anything, the thing that really impressed people and really kind of convinced people that he was a huge talent. Because the actual jokes were pretty lame. And that was part of his act. Like, he'd do those terrible nursery rhymes. That was part of his act. It was all in his delivery and his the performance of this caricature. But when he did those impressions at the end of the act, he was so great in them. And they were so detailed and so, like, unquestionably, this is a very talented performer. So my expectations for Ford Fairlane were pretty high. Now, I'd already seen him actually live. I saw him, I think it was 1989 or something. I saw him in Buffalo. My expectations were pretty high because I thought this guy could be a real movie star. And in fact, Rennie Harlan talks about this in the commentary. But honestly, I was incredibly disappointed with Ford Fairlane. And I had not ever seen it since last night. Like, from its original theatrical run, I'd never seen it again since last night in preparation for this. So I was really interested when you told me about doing this. I said, you know what? It's going to be really interesting to revisit Ford Fairlane and see if I, you know, how I look at it today.
I think I saw it on video when it was on VHS. I remember seeing it, and this must have been early 90s. And the one thing that kind of stuck out for me, and when I rewatched it, is that it, to me, it's such a sort of a you want to talk about, like, when we did the Free Jack episode and you were saying, you know, this is a guilty pleasure movie. It's like a movie that, you know, is trash, but you enjoy it for some reason. I would say that for me, in parts, it's enjoyable that way. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it doesn't take itself seriously. And the cameos are interesting. And we'll get into that. Some of the different actors who play these different roles. And the whole thing even almost seems cartoonish. Like, I almost wish that Rennie Harlan went one step further to make it cartoonish, even beyond where it is, because then it could have played so much more bizarrely and maybe would have actually worked as a film. To me, it kind of fails in points because it doesn't go far enough on the cartoon level.
Rennie Harlan actually addresses that on the audio commentary. He says that it's not quite enough of anything. So it kind of treads this middle line where it's not sexy enough, or it's not adventurous enough, or it's not humorous enough. I think he really talks about how they cut back on the humor and that it could have been one step further as far as that goes, and that would have put a whole new spin on it. So yeah, I think even Rennie Harlan would agree with you that it's not as cartoony as it probably should have been. And there are some crazy moments to it. But yeah, he could have pushed the envelope a little bit more.
The one thing that really I remember from it, in terms of, there's a line, he's walking into the club and the one girl's like,
hey, look, write down my number. 555-6321. Got it?
Yeah. Wait a minute. 555's not a real number. They only use that in the movies.
Oh, shit, honey. What do you think this is, real life?
If the film actually was a bit more reflexive unto itself and took itself as opposed to try to be serious at certain points and just said, this is a film and it's going to be as absurd and ridiculous as we want to make it, and took the gloves off, as you were saying, it would have gone, I think it would have gone a little bit better.
Let's go get into the plot a little bit, just for folks who haven't had the pleasure of The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, and talk about how it kind of unfolds. I mean, the movie was based a long time prior to two short stories that were kind of serialized by Rex Weiner. And those were very steeped in this kind of Raymond Chandler tradition, where it's this private eye. He's in New York for the first adventure. He's in L.A. for the second one. And, you know, it really speaks to that whole, the old school, looking for the girl, unraveling the mystery, all this kind of stuff. And that whole thing kind of plays out in the movie itself. I mean, he's a down and out detective. I mean, every good detective worth his salt is down and out when the movie begins, or shortly will be. He's receiving gifts instead of payment for things. He's getting koalas from NXS. He's getting gold watch from Josie and the Pussycats. And so he's not making his rent. He's not paying his assistant, you know, the ever troubled and always in love with the boss assistant, who's played by Lauren Holly in this case. And he gets put onto this case where he has to find this girl, Zuzu Petals, and he's put onto it first by Gilbert Gottfried, who plays a shock jock called Johnny Crunch, and then he gets put onto it also by Priscilla Presley's character, and he has to find this girl, and it just takes him all through this whole thing. And it's funny because Zuzu Petals doesn't even show up until really far into the movie. When I was rewatching it again tonight, I was like, when is this girl going to show up? I forgot how long it takes for her to finally get there. But it's kind of good that she doesn't get there for too long, because her character is really obnoxious. She's kind of this really vapid rocker girl, and she pretty much is just this kind of MacGuffin that helps us unravel this mystery that leads into this whole plot that talks about the corruption of the music industry and how, you know, things aren't as good as they used to be.
I think you're giving it too much credit by going into that much detail. No, because they basically slap on, you mentioned like the sort of, you know, the detective film noir type thing. They slap on that as a template. It's interesting to compare this to a movie that does the same thing but more successfully, Ace Ventura, because it's just a gimmicky private eye detective story, you know, that's absurd. Whereas Ford Fairlane's the rock and roll detective, he's the pet detective. The difference is, in Pet Detective, it's really funny. It's got some really funny moments, and it's really outlandish, and it's a genuine character that Jim Carrey created for that movie. Whereas the problem with Ford Fairlane, one of the many problems, and especially this was a very bad move for Andrew Dice Clay, because they just took the Andrew Dice Clay character and renamed him and injected him into this pretty lame conceit for a movie. You know, a lot of the jokes from that Dice Man Cometh were recycled. You could have a drinking game for the recycled jokes. Many of the punchlines they actually just pulled out of his stand-up act.
I only needed to be held.
You got the bonus plan, honey.
Ford, we just needed to be held.
You got the bonus plan.
So at the time, if you were aware of that stand-up routine and you went to see the movie, I was expecting, I saw the potential for a movie star in this guy, especially when he was doing all those great impressions of the great 70s actors like Stallone and Travolta and Pacino, because he really did have that kind of charisma. I thought, okay, this is going to be good. This guy's going to be a movie star. Let's see what sort of movie he's in. So it was really lame that they just plugged the Dice Clay character into this Ford Fairlane. It should have been a unique construct that showed some of his range, and it wasn't. And the other thing was, I hated the setting. Right off the bat, Vince Neil, the LA music scene of the late 80s, it's a disaster. Rennie Harlan on the audio commentary said something like he wanted it to have a cool vibe with the music and the clothes and the architecture. It's an absolute horror show. It's an aesthetic that in 1989 just made my skin crawl. And 22 years later or whatever, I still haven't warmed to it. There's a certain gawk value in looking back and seeing some of the cameos, for sure. but it's so tacky and so cheap and tasteless. And it's sad to hear Rennie Harlan think at one point in his mind it was cool.
Well, the thing that's interesting that you bring up about the music, and this is what I realized when I was watching it, is the movie came out in 1990. And probably within about 9 months, a certain band would come out of Seattle and destroy this big, dumb rock idea that's in the film where, you know, Nirvana comes out, all the Seattle bands come out, and then all of this, like, hair metal, Vince Neil, Motley Crue, Poison, whatever you want to call it, stuff from the 80s just is killed dead. It's like running a stake through Dracula's heart, dead. Ford Fairlane, if anything, represents the end of an era. There'd be no way that you would do a film like that with that kind of, like, music stuff. That's that, because that era died like 9 months later.
The original conceit was Ford Fairlane, the new wave detective. So it was really kind of set, even it was being written when new wave was already kind of passed, but it was kind of a nice look back at the new wave scene and everything. And I think had it been a different character, or I guess even if Clay had been kind of cast more as like a, you know, like an Elvis or a 50s kind of rocker who's just completely out of time and in this kind of more new wave stuff, but having it set at that very particular time of that 89 into 90 kind of scene, I think that does kind of, you know, it puts it too much in one particular time. It doesn't have any kind of, like, you know, even if they had, like, turned back the clock 5 or 6 years and, you know, kind of put that 1985, 84 under their lens, I think that would have been kind of a funny thing to do back then, and it would continue to be funny all these years later.
It's interesting that you bring up the 1950s idea, because to be honest, his character in terms of styling is kind of a 50s character. I mean, his hair's slicked back, he's, you know, got the jacket kind of thing, and there's a scene where he sings a song which to me is more of a 50s throwback song than it is of the modern era of when this was made, 89-90. So I think that it's in there, but they just didn't bother to tease it out and pull it out further.
You're right, Rob, as far as the teasing out of the 1950s stuff, and there is this kind of mishmash thing going on. Even that they give him a guitar from Jimi Hendrix seems kind of against the character type. You know, if he is this kind of 50s person, I would think that he would be really into, like, you know, Gene Vincent's guitar or Eddie Cochran's guitar or something. But they just had to make it so, I don't know, generic that it was Jimi Hendrix's guitar, because everybody knows who Jimi Hendrix is.
That's not in focus. That the potential for that is there, fish out of water. Like, if his perception of what rock and roll was gone, then it would have actually put all the other stuff into perspective, because it's like a hodgepodge of really bad late 80s music in LA, from the Motley Crue element to the Tone Loc to the Morris Day. Actually, the Morris Day Sheila E. stuff was the stuff that I sort of liked, because I'm into that stuff. But the other music that's represented is not a flattering depiction of the time, but it was a pretty horrendous time and place, to be honest.
This is the only film I can think of off the top of my head where Gilbert Gottfried's in it, and you can actually hear his real voice at one point when he's having sort of that heart-to-heart conversation with Ford Fairlane about this girl that he's trying to find and all that stuff. Like, I was like, wow, that's what he actually sounds like when he's not doing this thing here, you know? I got this voice. The other thing that I like, and it took me a minute or two to figure out that it was actually her, was even though it's a really cliched kind of character that you see in all private investigator films, is Lauren Holly as sort of his girl Friday thing, you know, the assistant. I think she does a really good job given the material that she has. Those cameos are good. And then Ed O'Neill, I already knew by the time I saw this film from Married with Children. Put him in anything, and he's usually pretty good.
Yeah, he's great in it. He's great
in it. Yeah, and if you look at it, I guess if we look at the music through the film, it seems to hit every decade up to the current. So he represents the disco era. So there's this whole, like, hatred of disco thing that's in there, which, talking to my older relatives who, you know, were into rock music when disco was around, was a reality, at least in this area, where there were people who were like, disco sucked. You know, if you were a rocker, you were into rock, you weren't into disco. But there's this whole, like, funny thing with Ed O'Neill and his character and that Booty Time song that's just hilarious.
You got to wonder how that came about. Like, oh, we need a guy to play a cop who was a former disco star in the 70s, Ed O'Neill. How would they make that connection?
Picking up on what you were saying, Rob, as far as, you know, comparisons to Free Jack, I kind of wanted to see more of Morris Day and Ed O'Neill. Like, when they finally get together at the end of the film and Morris Day has that appreciation for Booty Time and they get into a little conversation and go off into the sunset kind of thing, I was like, that's the movie I want to see. I want to see the sequel about Morris Day and Ed O'Neill, you know, and maybe call it Booty Time. Why not?
That would have been an infinitely more entertaining film.
I love Morris Day. And so to see him in anything, it was so great. I mean, because, you know, he steals the show when it comes to Purple Rain. So seeing him in this, I was very glad to see him.
Robert Englund sums it all up with that desperately awful Cockney accent. Maybe the most vile attempt to do a Cockney accent in all of film history. He makes Dick Van Dyke look like John Lydon or something, you know.
Hello, hello.
Even though I wasn't really hearing the accent, with him sort of dressed in this leather and almost S&M gear, I was getting Rob Halford flashbacks. So
what I've read is that was supposed to be Billy Idol for a while, and I would have loved to have seen what Billy Idol could have done had he tried to act.
You could do a whole show on movie parts that Billy Idol almost got. Because, you know, he had a whole career. He was going to do King Death with Toby Hooper. He had a much bigger part in the Doors movie, but he got into that terrible motorbike accident, gibbled himself, and he was relegated to a cameo. This is a part he should have got. He was plagued by all these like roles he was supposed to get because he really wanted to do movies. And it just eluded him. For one reason or another, it just eluded him. I'm not sure what that would have been like, but I think one of the best bits for me in this movie is actually the Billy Idol song Cradle of Love, because it accompanies that sorority house scene, which is got to be the best part of the movie. And just the reaction of Andrew Dice Clay as he steps into that sorority house, and it's just wall to wall filled with all these kind of like 1989 dancer size girls in those horrible outfits, but gorgeous drop dead looking girls. And his reaction, he's like a kid in a candy store. He's just looking all over the place. It's amazing. And actually, I have to say, Dice Clay is great in the film. It's everything else surrounding it and the choices they made to how to depict the character that's problematic. But he definitely does possess genuine movie star charisma.
I totally was down with Dice. I thought that his charisma was really good. I came into this movie very much from a different angle than you did. I had not seen the special. I really wasn't familiar too much with this guy. I mean, I got the joke when he talked about being banned from MTV. I remember people not wanting to be on Saturday Night Live with him when he was there. I believe like Nora Dunn and all these other cast members were like, no, we're not going to do that. But I was really coming to him as Andrew Dice Clay, the actor, having seen him, of course, in Pretty in Pink and in Wacko and then Casual Sex. I thought he was really good in Casual Sex and came to it just actually I was working at the movie theater at the time, and you know, every movie is better when you see it for free, but this was a perfect movie for me, summer of 1990, getting to see this for free and seeing it with a whole bunch of my coworkers, you know, who are all 18, 19, 20 years old. So it was pretty much a perfect brainless summer movie for me, and so it still holds up for me 22 years later.
See, again, if you're not aware of the special, then you wouldn't realize that dozens of the jokes were just pulled from his stand-up routine. You know, I'd be interested to see what the script was like, because obviously I don't know if they at the script level just transcribed the jokes from the act, or if that was decisions that they made while they were filming to incorporate that stuff.
The script is markedly different. The script is definitely free of all of those one-liners. And I think that I'm going to have to, we'll be playing back the interview with Daniel Waters in a little bit here, but I believe that he was aware that Clay was going to be in it, but he wasn't necessarily tailoring the script for Clay. He wasn't going through and peppering it with all that. I think that all that stuff came later. I mean, definitely the voiceover stuff, and especially the lines that, I mean, even not being familiar with the special, I could pick out some of the lines where I'm like, okay, yeah, this sounds like it was coming from, you know, something else, pre-existing material. When it came to Andrew Dice Clay, I pretty much knew the dirty nursery rhymes, and that was about it. And I know he doesn't do that, but there were other times where he was saying lines, and I was like, okay, yeah, this seems like it's from, you know, like the Neil and Bob and those kind of lines.
Exactly.
Those were not necessarily in Waters' script when the first or second draft were done. I think most of that stuff was added to later on.
The best line in the movie, and it was not from the act, but it's when Wayne Newton is talking about how to get rid of the taste or of that horrible 80s singer that he's inflicting on the world.
Just have to learn to tune it out. I recommend Stravinsky and Wagner.
I recommend Smith and Wesson.
When it came to the reviews of this film, all of the reviews that I read, I probably went back into the archives and dug up probably about a dozen reviews of this movie, and all of them focused, I would say almost all of them, focused on two things. One of them was Andrew Dice Clay's scene of picking up the microphone and doing the song during that scene that we were talking about where Kyle Troy is in there and he pushes him aside and does this scene. And all of the critics were just talking about how awful it was that Andrew Dice Clay comes in and he's kind of like the savior for these black studio musicians, which I found very kind of like, okay, that's what you guys are going to pick up on. And then the other thing is, speaking of Daniel Waters, all of the critics had to point out that this was such a fall from grace of Daniel Waters after he had done Heathers. Everybody seemed to love Heathers, but how dare he, you know, even be involved in this kind of trash? And everyone had to rake him over the coals at least a little bit. I felt so bad for him reading these reviews.
Let me ask you a question. Did you get Dice Clay for this?
I have not been able to get Dice Clay, and it really pisses me off. I have gone to his agent several times. The first time was when he was starting to do his stuff on Entourage. So it was, no, Andrew is way too busy. And I hit him again recently, and it was really weird because it's like the guy says, did you get Rennie Harlan to do it? And I said, I've been talking to Rennie. You know, here's who I've got. You know, I'm a legitimate kind of person. You know, I've talked to these people. Maybe you could talk to Clay. And plus, I've also kind of got this in, you know, being friends with Graydon Clark, and Graydon's working on this autobiography. And I was thinking it would be great to get, you know, other people that Clark had worked with. And I said, you know, hey, and plus, you know, I'm doing this thing with Clark. I'd love to talk to Andrew about Wacko, and, you know, because that movie kind of gave him a start. And the agent was just like, yeah, okay, I'll let Andrew know. But that's it. That's as far as it ever went. No Dice, and as of this recording, no Harlan, even though I've been speaking to his assistant since February.
He does a good commentary track, though.
He does. He does a good commentary. That was good. And he does seem to have a good perspective about the film.
Yeah, he apologizes for
especially
it.
Especially the language.
Did you see that Andrew Dice Clay is listed on the IMDb as being in the next Woody Allen film?
I know. I can't believe it. That would be pretty.
That would be great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. I wonder if it's just a small role as a, you know, a side part, like a walk-on part. I think probably, but it'd be great to see him in an interesting role where he can do something to kind of model his persona more theatrically and take it into some different areas. The sad thing watching this, Rennie Harlan talks about it, and I felt this at the time when I saw it 22 years ago, and my opinion has not changed after watching it last night. The sad thing is it's a squandered opportunity for a guy with a lot more potential than he ever realized. He looks so comfortable on camera. He's so comfortable in that character. And that's the sign of a very talented performer who can create a persona and inhabit it very comfortably. So comfortably, in fact, that there's moments in Ford Fairlane where he goofs off and Rennie Harlan talks about it. There's that great moment where he comes out of the club and he walks to his car and he just starts doing this silly walk. He can get away with it. If an actor is aware that they're able to do that, then they can do it and change the parameters. Stallone is a great example. I don't think there's a more idiosyncratic performance captured on screen than Rocky. He can craft other characters too, you know, almost equally as convincing, maybe not as successful or as iconic, but he's a real performer. And I think Dice Clay exhibited enough of that, but his movie career just flatlined after this. Rennie Harlan said it was the result of the controversy and the backlash.
Now, I have to say, though, his next film, Brain Smasher, A Love Story, is one of my favorite films as well.
Which I haven't seen that film, though, because I really lost... This film really killed it for me. I was so disappointed with him in this movie that I really lost touch with him. So it might be interesting for me now that we've done this to go back and kind of pick up on some of the performances that he's done subsequently.
I've compared him, or maybe we all have compared him to, like, you know, Elvis and Travolta and all these other people. When it comes to the milkshake always interests me in this movie. Do you guys see him being kind of like this buddy love character when it comes to the milkshake part? Because he seems to be, I mean, the way he walks into the club and everything really reminds me of the Nutty Professor, the way that Buddy comes in and just takes over the place.
What'll it be?
Well, I can speak to that in one sense, that Andrew Dice Clay cited the Nutty Professor and Jerry Lewis in that role as one of his biggest overall influences. And you can see that in his stand-up act, the kind of swagger and the exaggerated confidence of Jerry Lewis in those scenes when he turns into Buddy Love. Dice Clay just adopted that and actually incorporated it into a big part of his stage act and hence his persona, and it works its way into Ford Fairlane. All the way through the movie, you see traces of Buddy Love. It's at the heart of what he's doing. So very astute observation, Mr. White.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
That's why they pay you the big bucks.
Oh, yeah. Hand over fist. So I mentioned earlier that this film was based on a pair of short stories by Rex Weiner. And after the short stories, it kind of became this natural, you know, one of these, like, it was popular enough, just right place, right time, that this was going to become a movie. So it had this kind of long, sordid history of coming to the big screen. And what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break here. We're going to play some messages from our sponsors. And then we're going to play three interviews. We're going to play one with Rex Weiner, one with Floyd Buttrix, who was the producer of what should have been Ford Fairlane as of the mid-80s instead of 1990, and then Daniel Waters, who took over the screenwriting duties, much to his chagrin. when I asked him if he would come onto the show, he said that he had some non-flashbacks and that it took him quite a while before he would even answer my email after I threw Ford Fairlane at him. So, but yeah, we'll find out how Ford Fairlane came about right after this.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
It follows.net.
Hi, my name is Shane.
And I'm Monica.
And we are the two people.
We can't say anything. Oh, because they're going to censor us.
Is that the thing we signed?
Yeah.
We can't say anything. No bad words. No. So we can't tell them about our show.
No.
We can't actually tell them anything about what we do.
No.
Wow, that's really weird. Okay, well, hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Monica.
And
rantmehard.com.
That's all. Rantmehard.com. Go there and find out because we can't.
I can't believe we signed that thing.
I once saw an interview in which Dan Waters said every writer in town took a lunch meeting on Ford Fairlane when it was going around, and I was amused to hear that. You know, the way it happened was I was a journalist in New York in the 70s. My cohort included many of the so-called rock journalists of the time, including Lester Bangs, who was a close friend. Actually, I wrote for Cream, speaking of Detroit, and remained friendly with guys like Richard Meltzer and John Sinclair, who, of course, was one of the impresarios of Ann Arbor and the White Panthers and all that stuff. So I was in the milieu of the mid to late 70s rock and roll scene, punk and stuff, and it veered into country western. Guys like John Morthland, rock and roll connoisseurs and scholars of American music, were in my milieu. And I even had a band called King Rude that included some journalists that we were about the second or third band ever to play CBGB's when it opened up. Towards the late 70s, the scene was merging into something else, and there were all these great clubs where the next wave was being hatched, places like the Mud Club and Pier 3 and things like that. And I was hanging out at night, living a sort of vampirish rock and roll lifestyle in which I would get up around dusk and head out into the night and return in the wee hours at dawn. And I wanted to write about this, but in a way that wasn't strictly journalistic. And so I invented a character loosely based upon me and gave him the name Ford Fairlane. God knows why, but I always liked the name Ford Maddox Ford as a literary reference. So that's where that came from. And I struck up a relationship with the publisher editor of a magazine that no longer exists called New York Rocker. Made a deal where, for basically no money, they would publish a weekly installment, or it might have been monthly, I can't remember, or every 2 weeks, but a regular installment of 6 episodes in what I called an adventure, of the first adventure of Ford Fairlane. And I would write it each time based on whatever was happening. And the challenge for me was to create a fictional character who interacted with real characters and thereby make that fictional character seem real. Going to real clubs, commenting on real current events, real music, real bands, figures within the scene, club owners and so on, real bars and joints all across Manhattan. This fictional character, Ford Fairlane, became sort of real in readers' minds. I actually did see some graffiti in a bathroom somewhere in one of the clubs that said, Ford Fairlane sucks or something like that. That's when I knew people were reading me. And so so that was fine as far as it went. And then I got a job writing HBO Election Eve comedy special hosted by Steve Allen. And it was in 79, 80, something like that. 80, I guess. Yeah, Reagan was running. I went out to Hollywood. HBO was a new entity. They had new offices in the Century City Towers. I was on the top floor. The head writer was Paul Krasner, who was the creator of one of the first zines called The Realist.
How did you get that gig? Were you known for your...
Well, that's it. Well, Paul Krasner, so he was a friend of mine from the from my political days in New York. I was part of the underground scene, and he is a recognized satirist. He just had an interview with Andrew Breitbart in Playboy magazine, and he was the co-author of the Lenny Bruce autobiography. And so, funny guy, and we made each other laugh. So he was the head writer, and he hired me to come out. So while I was out there, I took Ford Fairlane on vacation and had him experience an adventure as I explored L.A. for the first time. So I did that, had some fun in the clubs in L.A. I mean, Meltzer was out there. I saw Darby Crash and the Germs. I saw X. I saw, you know, all of the L.A. punk bands in their prime and the clubs that were happening at that time. It was very cool. So I put all that into my second Ford Fairlane adventure. That L.A. adventure was published in the L.A. Weekly. So I was in L.A. for about 6 weeks and then went back to New York. And I had a, and I actually took a job with Swank, the magazine for men. It was a girly mag, and I was having fun with that. I think at that time I was interviewing girls for the Centerfold when the phone rang, and it was some guy from who claimed to be a producer from Hollywood saying that he liked the Ford Fairlane series and wanted to make a movie on it. And I hung up on him because I thought it was one of my friends pulling my yo-yo. But sure enough, 6 months later, I was out in Hollywood with a contract, under contract to Columbia Pictures, which at that time was owned by Coca-Cola. And the producer was a producer-director named Floyd Mutrix, M-U-T-R-U-X. Well, he did the first movie that had a rock and roll soundtrack that was deliberately synced to the action. It wasn't just like, you know, Hollywood used to treat rock and roll as something to put on, you know, cheesy surf movies or something, and you just sort of hired a music supervisor who would just hire some friend to do some kind of ersatz rock and roll. But nobody had taken the music of the time and really matched it to the action with real feeling and passion for the music itself. And so he did a movie called Dusty and Sweets McGee. And so he was a real kind of indie guy. He was into the music. He was into the scene, very hip. He latched on to those stories, which his assistant, actually, a guy named Neil, whose last name escapes me, who showed him the LA Weekly stories and said, hey, you should check this out. So he read the stories and tracked me down, somehow got us a contract at Columbia Pictures to do a movie based, a feature film based on my stories. Now, I had a literary agent at the time who did one of the smart things that's ever been done in my career, which was to lock down the original rights to the stories, to the original material, and did not sell those outright to Columbia. In fact, they were just optioned, and I was commissioned on top. So for that, there was a payment, and then I was commissioned on top of that to write the screenplay, co-write it with Floyd, my director-producer. So I went out there to do that. The studio put me up, gave me a fat per diem. Neil became my sort of chauffeur and gopher, and I got to go all over town, driven around Ferraris, Floyd's Ferrari and his Mercedes. He had a collection of antique cars. And we basically did drugs and booze and teenage girls all over L.A. in every strip joint and bar in town, supposedly writing this screenplay, which I thought, you know, would probably be an easy thing to do. I'd do it in 3 months and head back to, you know, cash the check and head back to New York. Because I never in my life imagined being in L.A., Hollywood, having anything to do with movies or TV or any of that crap. I was a journalist and a literary guy, and that was my aspiration. And Ford was just a lark. And, you know, I thought maybe it would catch somebody's interest and maybe expand into a series of cheapo books or something, but never did I imagine I'd be out in Hollywood writing a movie based on it. And but there I was, and having a damn good time of it.
I'm in the middle of doing the rewrite, and I'm on rehearsal for Boys in New York City. I'm on this break, so let's have a great conversation and real right to it.
Can you tell me how you got involved with Adventures of Ford Fairlane?
Yeah, I was at the Farmer's Market. It's a place I go every day. It's on 3rd and Fairfax. I went there for about 20 years. I wrote probably 40 or 50 movies there. And I had an assistant by the name of Neil who was working for me, and he was reading the LA Weekly a lot. I think it was serialized in the Weekly. I don't know how it got to me. I don't know how it came out. I got into the Weekly, but it was. He was talking to me about it. He mentioned it. I was sort of in the middle of doing, you know, I'd done a lot of cop movies and detective movies. It was a place called the China Club, which was kind of a, you know, new wave, whatever club. I was going there a lot. I was listening to a lot of that music, not necessarily punk music, but the Pretenders and the Eurythmics and Soft Cell and Clash and all the kind of English new wave bands. And here, too, X, LA kind of edgy bands. So I started thinking about writing a story about, a new wave detective. Rex had some concept about it, but he wasn't, Rex was not exactly a screenwriter. He'd been a journalist. We fooled around a lot for a year. I wrote probably 3 or 4 of them because I was going to serialize it. One was, I think, called The Girl with the Purple Hair. Second one was called Downtown Dick. One was about a runaway that turned into a whole other adventure. The Girl with the Purple Hair was someone who was shooting a music video. She was facing upstage, and there was a murder that took place during the video. She was the only one that was facing the shooter, saw the shooter, and then after the video, she went into hiding. And for Fairlane to saw, and it was his partner, who was kind of a sleazy guy. He'd had a partner for a long time. The guy kind of raised him, but he didn't really, the most ethical of partners. Anyway, his partner was in the line of fire, and his partner was shot. And even though he didn't want to work the case, he wanted to just get out of it. The girl ran away, and he knew he had to do it. So he then has to find the girl with the purple hair. And, of course, in doing so, there becomes a romance. And there was a long backstory where he had been in love with someone in the 70s. They used to go to the whiskey a lot, and he got himself in a little trouble with the girl. And they knew if they stayed together that they would keep getting in trouble. And the only way to survive was to not see each other. She committed suicide. And it turns out that the girl with the purple hair was her little sister. It's a story of little sister. And it turns out that the girl that committed suicide actually didn't commit suicide. And it, one of the last scenes is after the other case is off, he goes to where he finds where she is and sees that she has a normal life, and he sees her for a second. And they both know that things are better left as they are. And he ends up getting to go out to watch spring training. I'm just remembering it. I haven't thought of it in probably 20 years. They were kind of Chandler-esque. In a sense, it was like Marlo. It's like Little Sister, the classic L.A. detective. But, in the 80s, he was a loner, and he was always, he's a guy with fractured character definitions. But he's ethically, he's still a survivor. And, ultimately a good guy. I think the whole thing was he was just trying to get to winter baseball spring training. That was just the favorite thing in life to do, was go to spring training. I don't remember how it ended up. I never saw the movie. I know that sounds strange, but there's a couple of movies that I worked on that I've never seen. I wrote many variations of it, and I really liked it, and I was going to direct it, and I was going to do it first with Mel Gibson. This was right around the time of Mad Max. That was my plan, anyway. I was doing Dick Tracy with James Caan. Cast always change. Oh, and I was going to do Fort Fairlane with Mickey Rourke. Those were kind of the cast changes. So I kind of was balancing. I was dealing with both of those detectives at the same time, and both the cast. But I really liked Fort Fairlane. I was very infected by all the music.
Anyway, so we wrote this screenplay and handed it in, and by that time, Columbia had been sold by Coca-Cola to the Japanese, and so they threw out all of their development projects, as is normally done when a studio is sold, and so the project went into turnaround. Well, I let Floyd handle all of that and toss it into my agent's lap and let him deal with it. And there began a saga in which over the years it would just go into, it would get picked up by some studio. They would option the underlying rights to the stories. So that would be some money for me. And then they would commission a screenplay, and I'd do a draft, and then they'd hand it off to other writers, and then it would go nowhere, and then go into turnaround, and then it would start all over again. So it sort of went through, I wouldn't say every studio in town, but many studios. It was one of these projects that was always about to happen, and it never quite happened, until finally Joel Silver got in touch and said, I want to make this. He had Rennie Harlan in hand. Die Hard 2 was not quite ready, but he wanted Rennie to direct it. But meanwhile, he wanted him to prove himself on something, and so he picked up this. And I met with him, and I said, here it is 8 years later. I came here to do this movie. In the meanwhile, I had done, Miami Vice and a few other projects. I was one of the first writers hired on Miami Vice. I said, you know, Joel, I'm kind of weary of Ford. You know, he started out as a new wave detective, and now, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he's, you know, a polka detective or a jazz detective. But, you know, he's gotten older. I've gotten older. You know, we got to get this made. What's the guarantee you're going to actually make this picture? And we were sitting in his Frank Lloyd Wright house in the Hollywood Hills. And he said to me, you know, Rex, I have two Frank Lloyd Wright houses. He showed me his closets full of, you know, Japanese designer suits. He says, I've got, you know, an ex-wife or two or, I don't know, whatever. But he says, I've got very high overhead. I've got to make this movie. I said, fine, Joel. It's yours. So, you know, the agents did the deal and some nice money involved. And so I wrote two drafts, maybe even three, possibly four, working with his development person, a young woman who shared an apartment with a bunch of writers. Anyway, she handed it off to Cap and Arnott, and they did their disastrous work on it. I just sort of let it go, as you do in Hollywood. And they did their pass on it. And then I guess it went to Waters, who was hot from Heathers. I noticed that a lot of the things he put in there took the screenplay back from the weird trajectory that the other two guys had put it on and brought it back to, you know, my sense of humor and my sense of L.A. as a character in the piece. Some actual characters like the kid that's the sidekick, that was an original character I had in that the two guys, Cap and Arnott, took out. And so, you know, it was much closer to my original intention. And I was not that aware of Dice Clay at the time. I mean, I saw Sam Kinison at the Comedy Store. I was aware of him, but it wasn't really written for him. A lot of people make the mistake that it was written for him. Perhaps Waters may have been cast at that time, and Waters was tasked with tailoring it to him. I'm not sure. But it turns out he was right for the part, I would say, and maybe too right for it. But in any case, it became a vehicle for him, even though it wasn't created for that. He's actually a good actor and a very nice guy. It went into production, and I got my big fat production bonus and check, and I went to the set because the Dice Man requested that the original writer come to help him pump up some jokes. We sat in this trailer, and we had some laughs. I'm from Brooklyn originally, so, you know, so is he. We connected on that level. And at some point, he says, you know, I got to do something, and he grabs me and pulls me outside on the set where they're, you know, the gaffers and the grips are all setting up shit, and the DP is, you know, trying on lenses, and he says to everybody, listen up, everybody, listen up here. He says, this here is Rex Weiner. I want you all to know that he's the reason we all got jobs. And I thought that was very generous of him and appropriate and interesting, because eventually when the Writers Guild had its arbitration to see, you know, which of the writers would get what kind of credit, it turns out that my credit was not championed, I hear, was not championed by the producer, by Joel, but Waters and the other two guys got credits, and I got based on characters created by, which when I looked at the picture and went to the premiere and everything, was fine with me, and especially in view of the subsequent flop of the picture, much better to have that credit than to be accused of writing a bad screenplay that sank. But it wasn't the screenplay, and it wasn't anything. It was really Dice Clay and the backlash at the time, which was a time of intense activity by women and the feminist movement. So the movie flopped at the box office. It was a $20 million dollar picture, which at that time was considered large, and I'm not sure if it made its money back at that time, but since I think it's acquired a following on video, and I've often received compliments, not just from guy fans like yourself, but from women who always say, that's the funniest picture I've ever seen, I love the picture, and it's never gotten its due, so I agree.
How did you get involved with Adventures of Ford Fairlane? That was another one where you came in and did a lot of doctoring on that, correct?
I worked 2 weeks on Demolition Man and, like, you know, and did most of my work on Demolition Man while standing in line for one of the last episodes of Johnny Carson, the Tonight Show. And that was what I would call a rewrite. I actually, like, you know, sad to say, there was definitely a couple drafts of Fort Fairlane, but I spent much more time on Fort Fairlane creating a script. Although, you know, you wouldn't know by dice treated the script at times. Yeah, no, I mean, it's got to be one of the great, just from critical responses, elevator drops of all time that, you know, went from Heather's to Fort Fairlane. But I was a huge fan of Joel Silver, and I've always had that high culture and low culture aspect to my taste and my writing. I was a big fan of, still Die Hard's one of my all-time favorite movies. And I was watching Lethal Weapon at Christmas, because it's a Christmas movie, so it was Die Hard, but it wasn't on video cassette at the time, and with my family, when I got a call from Joel Silver's people about this, and it was kind of like was definitely naively under the impression that it's the old Burr Reynolds thing of, you know, I'll do one for them and one for me and one for them. And it was kind of like, okay, I've done this movie, Heathers, that got good response, didn't really make a lot of money. I didn't really make a lot of money on it, but it's amazing just after that movie, even before the movie was made, just on the basis of the script, how many, you know, meetings I got off it. And, you know, you'd think, okay, this is a dark comic satire, so they're going to call me in to see if, you know, I want to do their dark comic satire. And it turns out, like, I get brought in for everything but dark comic satires, because nobody actually wants to make a dark comic satire. So, you know, we got Whitney Houston as a genie, you know, do you want to write it? Like, you know, and it's just like, okay, well, how did you get to here? Like, you know, I just remember when I was younger reading a article of Jim Jarmusch where he said, he came to L.A. and he was offered Porky's 2. And I'm like, okay, this guy's just being a New York, you know, jerk of, like, you know, overdoing it just to say. And then I realized, oh my God, I bet Jim Jarmusch did get offered Porky's 2. And Joel Silver was just like, he's kind of like the larger-than-life realization of what you think a guy, you know, what me, you know, a guy from Indiana thinks is a producer, you know. And it's just like, okay, this is the colorful character who says outrageous things. And, like, I'd met, you know, I've been, after months of meeting, you know, nice people and, like, you know, polite people, you know, it was great to meet him, and he was a huge fan of Heathers, and I just thought, okay, this is a detective in the music industry, I can do something with this. And then they flew me out to New Jersey, where Andrew Dice Clay was performing, and I saw him perform in a small club, and I thought he was this brilliant parody of machismo, like, okay, this guy's hilarious, because, like, I totally got, or what I thought, I got what he was doing, as far as, like, he is kind of like this macho buffoon. And I thought, oh my God, okay, this is who I have to use. And they kind of told me up front that that's who they wanted. You know, I can almost make him kind of like an Inspector Clouseau kind of like guy who, and we can have, you know, fun with, like, how much of a blowhard he thinks he is, which sometimes works in the movie. But unfortunately, what happened was, as the movie was being made, he got more and more popular. So suddenly, like, we had to listen, instead of him, like, as a hungry actor doing a script, you know, suddenly we had to listen to him more, and we had to, you know, laugh along with his ad-libs. And then we kind of disastrously, at the last minute, decided to add a narration onto the movie. And I wrote a narration for the movie, but that was almost completely thrown out for his kind of ad-libs. And here was the big mistake, though. The big mistake was, you know, he's still controversial, but first time I saw him, he's in this little club, and then after shooting, I saw him, and he's playing at the LA Forum, and it's, like, thousands and thousands of people, and I'm like, oh, and then suddenly, you know, what I thought, this kind of, you know, making fun of being a macho blowhard. He just is a macho blowhard, and was like kind of a Nazi rally. And it was like, uh-oh, I started worrying. But even then, if the movie would have came out when it was supposed to come out, it was supposed to come out in May, opening up against two movies that actually got worse reviews, Bird on a Wire and Cadillac Man, I think the movie still would have made more of a splash. But then at the time, they go, okay, this Andrew Dice Clay guy is huge. Let's wait 2 more months. And literally those 2 months, like, two moment, like the next day after the movie was supposed to open, he just was on Saturday Live, and he was horrible, and he was a jerk, and it was just like, and literally in those 2 months, he just became the lovable, the guy you love to hate, to do as this guy you hate, you know. So whatever the flaws and guilty pleasures of the movie, I think people were just ready to despise the movie, even like the audience that would have liked it. And so it was kind of painful that when the movie came out. But I was already shooting this big at the time the movie came out. I was already in New York shooting this next huge hit with Bruce Willis on Hunt for the Hawk. So I was fine, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're gonna come out of this smelling like roses.
Yeah, I was like, "Shoo! Thank God I got out of that one." Well, I always called my career the failing upward.
Well, I think it was smart to do a voiceover for Ford Failing because there really was kind of a Chandler-esque quality to it.
You know, obviously, I can only think of the moments where he went off the script. I remember when the idea came up, I thought, "Okay, yeah, this does make sense that we can do something with this," you know, because it certainly was in keeping with the, you know, the genre.
I had talked to Rex about this, and he had nothing but great things to say about what you had done to the script, because apparently he was not happy with the version that they were thinking about going with originally. And he said that you went really back more to his original stories and original vision of the character.
I mean, his stuff was grounded in actual a rock and roll detective. The other version that was done, that was just kind of a silly comedy for comedy's sake, and it just didn't play. But yeah, I mean, at least, like, I thought the more grounded in some sort of reality, the better.
Well, and I thought it was nice too that you're kind of, you know, softening the character by, you know, having the kid and everything.
And that kid's performance is a little off. But I did want to, there was all these kind of tropes in the movie that I wanted to make fun of. Like, okay, you know, have, oh, the lovable kitty's got to, you know, make the kid an asshole. And like, you know, I tried to make the female characters actually have funny lines. And, you know, I think Lauren Holly is probably the most successful element of the movie. I really like her performance and like what she did. But, you know, it was a tough fight, you know. You know, Andrew kind of like just takes on everybody.
Were you around much during the shooting, or were you not on the set on that one too much?
Yeah, I would visit the set. It was not like I was in the trailer writing frantically, rewriting scenes. It's just funny, you know, and again, just as Andrew Dice Clay is a strange choice of star, Rennie Harlan was definitely a strange choice to direct a movie that had so many comedy elements in it. And that's the thing, if you look at Joel Silver's movies, they're always, I'd say we both have tonal problems that, like, you know, and which I like. And again, it's why maybe people in Europe like, because they don't have the same slavishness of tone that American viewers seem to have, where you have to choose your major before the movie. And like, you know, I like the fact it's just big and violent and rated R, but a comedy as well as an action movie. I just remember those early meetings with Rennie, and his sense of comedy was always, you know, we have to have a scene where a guy is taking a shit reading a newspaper, and the car comes right through the house while he's taking a shit, and he looks up, looks at his damaged house, and then goes back to reading the newspaper like nothing happened.
I felt so bad. I went back, I dug through the archives and found a lot of reviews of the film from the time. But every art...
Well, I was actually trying to find Gary Arnold's review for the Washington Post. He wrote, and it was so well written too. It was a 4-star rave. And it was just like, if you only lived in a universe with this review, it would have been so happy. Because, I mean, it was just like, and it's got one of the greatest last lines in a movie since Some Like It Hot. And like, you know, just like, oh, yeah, all right. But then it was every other review of the movie. But it's funny, I do like, an exercise I do like to do from time to time is to type into Google, Daniel Waters underrated, and see what comes up. And, you know, so sad that I do that, but, you know, but it's the only way to find, you know, the reviews of Ford Fairlane that I want to read, you know.
You were very unfairly targeted in all of the reviews that I was reading. Like, they had to try it out. And this guy who made Heathers, he wrote the script. Can you believe this? And I was like, oh
my God. You know, Kenneth Turan made a living out of just, like, scolding me, because... Like, he was writing in GQ when Heathers came out, and he did this huge article on Heathers, and he said, like, you know, calling Heathers a movie about high school is like calling Moby Dick a book about a fish, and, like, just loved the, couldn't have loved the movie more, but couldn't have, and then he became head critic of the LA Times, and he, just every single thing I did after that, just, like, be these huge, like, diatribes, what happened to Daniel Waters? One of the great tragedies, like, you know, that I was, like, the subject of a TV movie, like, you know.
There you are in some gutter somewhere, you know, writing rewrites for Hudson Hawk or something.
But it is funny how most people, you know, at the time was horrible, but, you know, now it's funny because the movie's reputation in some weird way is improved by, you know, people who saw it when they were 8 on video cassette. And so now, like, you know, I get driven around to film festivals with judges, and then, like, it's always, like, the guy who's driving me around in the van, I'm like, you know, and there are people talking about Heathers, and, like, all of a sudden, then I'll make a Ford Fairlane joke, and he'll just stop the car, and, like, what'd you say? You wrote Ford Fairlane? Oh, my God, now that's a masterpiece. For better or for worse, every movie I do is packed. You know, I'm just like, I try to write really dense, try to get as much stuff as I can get in, and like everything I write has too many characters, it seems like. I think it leaves a lot of people like, what the heck? Like when they watch it first time, but you do get it. I try to write movies where you get some sort of completely different experience every time you watch it, because it does have so many small characters. I mean, when you take over Gottfried, though, that was funny. It brings back that Gilbert Gottfried was our first day of shooting, and he hadn't read the script. And, like, here, I'm coming out of a movie where, you know, like everybody, you know, religiously memorized their lines, and so this is my first day on the big movie, and, like, he's just so, like, kind of filthy, and he's nervous, and, you know, so, like, now I've learned to, like, especially on those roasts, I've learned to think Gilbert Gottfried's funny, but I've just always had an ugly, traumatic relationship with him, because he was like the losing of my virginity. That, like, this is not going to go well.
Because he's got that character that he uses as his defense mechanism too. I'm sure you didn't see the real Gilbert Gottfried, whatever.
Yeah, that's the problem. Even now, I can see the wheels turning, because I know it's not coming from a confident place of genius comedy, more out of a sweaty, flailing. Again, he can be funny, but like when he's still to this day, I wouldn't say does a lot of movies, you know. I mean, he can be that bird in Aladdin, because he doesn't have to be on camera, you know. But,
you know, you're talking about having too many characters and all that stuff, but I liked the way that the characters would kind of come in and out of the stories, especially in Ford Fairlane, like the Kari Wuhr character being in the beginning, you know, club scene, and then coming back and saving his bacon later on. I thought that was very nice.
Oh, my God. That sorority scene, wow. You're trying to cut down the script, and you know, and then everybody's like, oh, you can't just sorority scene. Oh, you really, that scene has nothing to do with anything. Like, that was a hilarious scene to be filmed, because, like, suddenly the movie had like 50 visitors to the set when we're shooting that scene. I just remember being crammed in a small kitchen at UCLA where we're shooting it, and with John Hughes, and meeting John Hughes for the first time, because, you know, at least I was younger then. I wasn't quite a dirty old man, but, you know, another thing I remember from writing Ford Fairlane is that there was a plot at some point, like, and we had a huge scene in a warehouse where they find all these, you know, DVD CDs and fake things, and, like, where the whole plot is explained, and then getting to the big warehouse scene was, like, you know, it was a typical layered script with a plot and everything, and as we're cutting down the script, well, can we cut down the sorority scene? Can we cut down this goofy comic scene? It's like, oh no, we got those are gold, you know. Can we just cut out this scene that explains the plot, and then we'll just move it to the warehouse scene? So it became a joke, like, we'll just move it to the warehouse scene. Don't worry, the audience is not paying attention. Once we'll have the warehouse scene, we'll explain everything, and it'll be great. And then, you know, you get the call from Joel Silver. So we're cutting the warehouse scene. But wait a minute, that's where we had moved the entire plot to the warehouse scene. And now, how are you going to cut the warehouse scene? And, oh, God. But that was very Joel. This is like Joel wants all the good stuff, you know. Rick Moranis used to do this talk show, like on SCTV, with the character on it, where he's playing this just loud producer who keeps moving his legs. And it's basically Joel Silver does a talk show, but he's doing Joel. It's not like a character that I've seen a lot on SCTV, but like I've seen the clips of him doing Joel, and it was pretty funny. I feel bad for Joel, because to me, I still to this day, I'm a huge Speed Racer fan. Like, I love his failures much more than Jerry Bruckheimer's successes. To me, Jerry Bruckheimer isn't putting himself out there, isn't doing kind of like these weird tonal mixtures. Like, you know, he just does Bruckheimer movies, you know, but Joel's still doing crazy stuff. Something that drove me nuts. There's a line in Ford Fairlane, and maybe Morris Day's enunciation isn't good, doesn't have enough quality to it or timber to it. But there's a line where he's right about to be shot by Wayne Newton. What a cast, Wayne Newton, Morris Day. But anyway, he's about to shoot back, and he says,
"What can I say, Don? You're a great producer. You're a great friend. I'm gonna miss you. What can I tell you? It's business."
With friends like you, who needs enemas?
With friends like you, who needs enemas? Okay, now it may not be the most amazing line in the world, but I thought it was kind of cute and kind of funny. Okay, you cannot believe how many reviews I got where it took three writers to come up with the line, "With friends like you, who needs enemies?" I'm like, what? And they keep saying. And then Siskel and Ebert review the movie, and they're like, "Here's how original this screenplay is." They actually have a character say, "With friends like you, who needs enemies?" And I'm yelling at the TV screen in front of all these people, "It's enemas! It's enemas!"
I never heard anything other than enemas. I hope that makes you feel better.
I think that's what you should title this. I've never heard anything but enemas. And going to Bobby Rivers, well, it's actually the happy ending to this. Is right before the movie came out, I heard Anderdice Clay on... he was doing a radio interview, and they ask him, my name being Daniel Waters, they ask him, who wrote the movie? And he's like, "Oh, yeah, this guy, this young guy, Bobby Rivers. Bobby Rivers wrote the movie." And at the time, it was like, hey, that's not very nice. Oh, my God, I spent so many hours at the internet, don't remember my name. And then the next day, the reviews come out, and I'm like, yes, Bobby Rivers. Daniel Waters wrote Heathers. Bobby Rivers. He's the evil alter ego who wrote The Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Got a 65 Cadillac, bad tire on my back, charge called to go black, but I ain't got you. Got women to the right of me, got women to the left of me, I got chicks all around me, but I ain't got you. I got the tab at the liquor store, I hit the number 444, I got a mojo. Don't you know, I'm all dressed up and no place to go. I got women to the left of me, I got women to the right of me, I got chicks all around me.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. We're talking about The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. We talked a lot about the film overall, but I want to know what you guys think. Does it work? Does it not work? I think I kind of have some of your answers so far, but what do you think, Mr. Feedback?
I'd say it was an absolute chore sitting through it last night.
I almost feel bad that you came onto the show and it was a movie you didn't enjoy.
Well, no, I don't feel bad because I found the whole thing interesting to do, to basically revisit this. That's why when you suggested it, you gave me a bunch of options for shows, and I picked this one because I thought it would be interesting to revisit, and it was, and it allowed me to kind of catch up with something that, you know, was a memorable chunk of that late 80s kind of pop culture for me, you know, especially after seeing him live and all that stuff at the time, too. So, no, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
You know, Rob, you had mentioned that Nirvana was, you know, kind of waiting in the wings and the whole grunge movement and all that stuff and alt, you know, alt rock and all that kind of, you know, just was going to explode in late 1990, early 91, or, you know, 1991, the year punk broke. So this movie, for me, really is such a time capsule of that one particular era. And it was so great. I mean, especially even hearing the, you know, the MTV news intro and seeing Kurt Loder in the VJ chair and everything. It was great, you know, because this was still in that era when MTV was playing music videos, which I know is very unusual for people to think about now. But so, yeah, you're totally right that this was just, you know, this moment of time.
I'll give you another one you've done an episode on that sort of fits in the same time era, although it's a much better film, is Tapeheads. When we talk about rock music and MTV and things like that, I mean, that's another one that sort of fits within that era, although it's not as I get the feeling with Tapeheads, they're making fun of that era as opposed to Ford Fairlane that wants to revel in that era and kind of tell you how great it is. And to be honest, all that Motley Crue, Poison, hair metal from the 80s, It's horrible. I hate that stuff.
It's very tacky, for sure. I mean, there was a great music scene in the 80s with the whole San Francisco thrash metal scene. That was good. But the whole hair metal manifestation of it was awful. But I have to say, I'm not a fan at all of the whole Seattle scene that came and took its place either. So for me, it's sort of like when you mentioned one took over the other, it's like out of the frying pan into the fire. Because the Seattle scene bothered me for a whole other reason. It was such a watered down, limp, ineffectual, safe, tiresome retread of something that was really vital and subversive from Britain from the 70s, that, you know, right down to that weak little like middle finger that Kurt Cobain gives the camera on the Nevermind cover, Nevermind, a reference to Nevermind the Bollocks. That I hated that whole stuff too. So for me, I'm torn. What do I hate more? The weak sloppiness of the Seattle grunge scene, or the tacky, bombastic obnoxiousness of the 80s LA cock rock scene? I'd probably have to go with the 80s one.
The records that got attention out of the Seattle scene were not worth the time half the time, but they led you to other things. And I have a friend of mine who says that, say what you will about Motley Crue, Poison, and the 80s hair metal, he believes that they're the gateway drug to much harder metal. So he says that's what happened to him. He started out listening to Cinderella and Poison and all that stuff, and then eventually worked his way up to Slayer. So if that's the case, so be it.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Totally sucks.
A preview from Tromeo and Juliet. Be sure to come back. We'll again be speaking to Will Keenan and Lloyd Kaufman. Plus, we'll have an interview, actually two interviews, with Juliet, Jane Jensen, about this reinterpretation of the William Shakespeare classic, of course, Romeo and Juliet. But before we sign off this week, I want to say special thanks to our special guest host, Feedback. So tell us, sir, what's happening over in the Great White North and all of your fun with Cinephobia and Rootmork.
Well, Cinephobia is sort of on a bit of a hiatus, only because I'm doing this weekly podcast for Rootmork at the moment, which has taken up not only the time that I've allotted to it, but all of my free time, apparently. I'm waiting for a window of opportunity to open up, and I'm going to delve into the Cinephobia archives because I have a couple of interesting bits I've recorded with your very own Mr. Mike White that are coming up.
I don't envy you for the editing job that you're going to have to do to those.
I don't envy you for this.
This is only going to be an hour and a half. It's not going to be the 7 or 8 hours that we spent talking about Impossibly Funky and Columbo.
That was mental, yeah.
Just one more thing.
No, Lieutenant. There is no just one more thing.
Cinephobia, definitely one of my favorites, and RoomWorks, at the interviews that you get on there, some of those shows have just been absolutely amazing. The interview with the guy who did Birdemic was epic.
That was definitely one of the most memorable moments, because he was here in Toronto. He showed Birdemic to an audience, and I got him very late after the screening. I think I started rolling tape on that at like 1 o'clock in the morning, all right? And he was very tired. And in preparation, I'd been watching all these different interviews that people had done. And they took either one of two tactics. One, they were very rude to him. Or two, they pretended like he was a real filmmaker doing a real movie. And I thought both approaches were quite condescending. So I decided that I would just be respectful, but press him for real responses and ask him tough questions about his film. And I will tell you, as you've heard in that interview, there was no way to poke through that thickly devised wall of delusion that this guy is now standing behind in order to justify the success of his movie. He has honestly convinced himself that Birdemic is a big hit movie because people think it's essentially amazing.
That you could go through that whole interview and not just bust out laughing or just attack him at some point and be like, are you f***ing kidding me? I mean, I don't think I could have done it.
It was hard, but I had an agenda in terms of like, I'm not going to be rude, because I saw some people being rude to him and I thought that was in bad taste. And I have a thing that I invited him into our sphere to interview. It's like you don't invite somebody over to your house and then they walk through the door and you say, I just wanted you to come in so I could tell you I think you're an asshole.
That's generally what Christmas is about, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, in my house.
I think that should be your next Rondo Hatton award-winning episode, was the Birdemic. Not to say that the other episodes that you've done haven't been that great, but I mean, that one just really takes the cake. And I was really impressed with the Jennifer Lynch interview, too.
Oh, thank you. I love all these accolades. It makes a nice change from all the abuse I get in other departments. Well, sitting across from Last Chance Lance getting told, you know, that I'm not worth anything. Your favorite radio personality. But listen, thanks a lot, fellas, for having me on. I'm a big fan of the projection booth. I'm a bit behind right now because I have 23 podcasts subscribed on my iTunes, and I got to get around to it. But I will eventually start monstering some more of the back episodes. But you guys, I was just telling my girlfriend today that you guys, you know, really set the bar low. So it makes my job easier. So thank you.
Oh, of course. Anything we can do to help. Hopefully we will be talking again, at least via Cinephobia Radio, and folks can check out that podcast at cinephobia-radio.com, and then there's RoomWorks Radio podcast, which is just available through RoomWorks.com?
Exactly, Roo-Morg.com.
Roo-Morg.com. All the best websites have dashes in them, I have to say. So, thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to stop by the Projection Booth website to see and hear more goodies related to the adventures of Ford Fairlane and other episodes of the show. And that, of course, is at projection-booth.com.
Yeah, and also don't forget to leave us a voicemail because, yes, Blade Runner. We want your thoughts on the original film, the re-edits, the final cut, you know, what Ridley Scott may have had for catering on one day or whatever, you know, whatever you want to talk about with Blade Runner, because we need to put this together. And also, given the fact that he just did all the fun with Prometheus, and now they're talking about a Blade Runner sequel, what do you think of that? So the number to call, 734-666-0800. That's 734-666-0800. We're lining that up right now, that episode, some special guests, and leave your messages today and become a part of it. You spare me with your questions. You haven't sound our lies. You always ask what it's all about. Don't listen to my replies. You say to me.
You're unbelievable. You're unbelievable.
Booty time, booty time, across the USA. Booty time, booty time, hey, hey, hey. Booty time, booty time, across the USA. It's booty time, booty time, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable.